Welcome to episode 161 of Behind the Mission, a show that sparks conversations with Sycamore trusted partners and educational experts. My name is Dwayne France, and each week I'll be having conversations with podcast guests that will equip you with tools and resources to effectively engage with and support military service members, veterans, and their families. You can find the show on all the podcast players by going to Sycamore.org/podcast. Thanks again for joining us on Behind the Mission. Our work and mission are supported by generous partnerships and sponsors who also believe that education changes lives. Our sponsor this week is PsychArmor, the premier education and learning ecosystem specializing in military culture content. PsychArmor offers an online e-learning laboratory that's free to individual learners, as well as custom training options for organizations. On today's episode, I'm having a conversation with Dr. Jason A. Higgins, the Digital Scholarship Coordinator for Virginia Tech Publishing, and an assistant professor who teaches on the Vietnam War, African-American history, and oral history. His book, Prisoners After War, Veterans in the Age of Mass Incarceration, was published by the University of Massachusetts Press in January of 2024. To find out more about Dr. Higgins by checking out his bio on our show notes, let's get into my conversation with him and come back afterwards to talk about some key points. Jason, so glad to be able to have a conversation with you about a topic that's particularly meaningful to me, veterans involved in the criminal legal system. Before we talk about your research and your book, I'd like to provide you an opportunity to tell us a bit about yourself and why this particular topic is such an interest to you.
I don't have a poignant personal story that can really describe to your audience why exactly I have immersed myself into the worlds of incarcerated veterans for the past 10 years. I'm not a veteran, and I've never been to prison. However, I'm deeply captivated by the stories of ordinary people who survive extraordinary events. I'm a first-generation college student, first in my family to graduate from high school. I was born and raised in Southeast Arkansas, where seemingly nothing ever happens. Generations of people and their families move to that area of the country and stay there. The exception is that sometimes people go to military service, oftentimes to war. And so I think that I was deeply fascinated by the people within my community who could tell stories. I was also non-traditional. I poured concrete before going to college for 5 years. And whenever I went to college, I kind of fell back on what I was good at and what most interested me in school, which was history and storytelling. So I majored in history. And as I embarked on that journey, I studied war, but I couldn't help but notice that most of my classes taught history from the top down, which didn't appeal to me as much on a personal level. I believe that whenever you dissociate the study of war from the human beings who experience them, then you're missing a huge part of that narrative. And too often in my educational experience, military history was taught on an operational basis, and it was almost devoid of any kind of human experience or voice. And I was most interested in that. I don't have many short stories, so I'll try to keep it brief, but I was studying the Pacific War, the Second World War, in college, and I was also doing a history methods class at the same time. I needed a project. I was a waiter. I worked my way through high school and college, and on Sunday afternoons, I would always have a group of military veterans coming in, drinking coffee, telling war stories, and I noticed that one of the veterans was a Marine who had survived some of the battles that I was studying in a book. And so I started talking to him. His name was Leslie Hoppers. At the time, he was 88 years old, and he had survived Tarawa, which, as you may know, is one of the most disastrous amphibious invasion in U.S. military history. And I thought it was just so powerful to be able to talk to someone who witnessed it, who had seen it, who had seen friends who died before even reaching the shore. And that started an oral history project. That was the first time I did an oral history interview with any veteran. And I would visit his nursing home on the weekends whenever I wasn't working or in school. And through a series of conversations with him, I recorded his story. It was a very powerful and moving experience for me. And he passed away a couple of years afterwards. That was very meaningful for me. And it made history alive. It made history seem more real than the abstract lesson that one can learn in a textbook. That was a successful project as well. It was the first time I ever flew on a plane. I went to Orlando, Florida, and I presented research at a national conference. And I thought, wow, this is something I could do. I didn't have any sense of what I wanted to do as far as going to graduate school, but I knew that was something that resonated with me powerfully. I continued my interest in studying and documenting the experiences of veterans. And because in my community, there were a lot of Vietnam veterans, so I started talking to Vietnam veterans. And I immediately recognized striking differences between what a Marine Corps veteran from the Second World War had experienced after the war and the Vietnam veteran generation. Unimaginable is the horror that he had seen both at Tarawa and Iwo Jima and the Philippines. He came home and had a relatively normal, healthy life. He was a pastor at a church. He had children and grandchildren. There was seemingly no trauma. At least he didn't disclose that trauma to me. I think it was part of that silent generation where World War II veterans just didn't talk about it. But I also thought it was more than generation. I thought there was something different about the homecoming experience that these generations had faced. Then I had an interview that made me never want to do another one. I interviewed a guy who was a gunner on a helicopter in Vietnam. He had never talked about that experience for 45 years. The only reason I think he agreed to do the interview with me was because I was friends with his niece. Now that I know about oral history best practices and ethics, I would have never done the interview to begin with. But I was naive. I was untrained, but genuinely curious about his stories. And so I interviewed him. His son was present. His son and the father never talked about that experience. And 45 years of alcoholism and various reintegration difficulties, undisclosed trauma, damaged that family relationship. And at one point during the interview, it became so heavy that I turned off the recorder. And I was just an observer to a moment between the father and son. And my human instinct was to stop recording and to just let these people have a moment to heal or try to heal or move forward together. And that scared me a little bit, if I'm being honest. I had done maybe 8 or 9 interviews at that point as an undergraduate. I graduated from college and went to graduate school at Oklahoma State University. I wanted to teach. I was a double major in English. I wanted to teach writing. I wanted to be an editor, things that I still do today. But Oklahoma had a really great oral history program. So after my first year of graduate school in English, I did a paid internship at the Oklahoma Oral History Research Program and fell back in love with doing oral history with veterans. And I did 30 interviews in one summer, and that put me on the path that I'm on now. So I guess that's a long way of saying the origin story is deep, and I do have a personal connection to the stories that these people tell me, but it's not one that I've lived myself.
Now, I find it really fascinating, and maybe I hadn't considered that. Obviously, not having studied history in the way that you did is the idea of history being taught from the top down. Yes, we're taught that the battles occur at this point. This is the details, right? People know about the Battle of the Bulge, but they don't know the individual stories of the people of the Battle of the Bulge unless there is a storyteller like the Band of Brothers or something like that, or even semi-fictional historical accounts of battles like the Killer Angels or something like that. Like, but really, that's what you're talking about is the individual stories. And I can imagine as you're talking to these veterans about their time in war and conflict, the story doesn't end in conflict. It continues. And I think continuing to pull that thread likely led you to things don't always turn out the fairy tale endings. Incarceration, involvement in criminal legal system ends up being a lot of the part of the rest of the story of these veterans.
Yes. And that's the other really meaningful insight that I learned early on is that too often history is taught that wars end with a ceasefire on a battlefield, and yet those battles continue for the people who experience them throughout their lifetimes. The really powerful thing that veteran studies does as a field, as a subfield, is it takes that framework of understanding military experiences and expands it to include veterans and their families, which I think is really powerful and meaningful. There were too many times did the Second World War history class end with the atomic bombings, right? But what happened afterwards and how is that connected to the nuclear arms race? And that's still top down, but if you add Vietnam into that, how did veterans reintegrated a point whenever they didn't have many resources to enable them to readjust in a healthy way? And that was one of the research questions that really led me down this path towards studying incarceration.
You've recently released your book, Prisoners After War, which looks at incarcerated veterans from Vietnam to today. And I think it's really interesting. Yes, having the greatest generation, World War II, Korean War, but really Vietnam, this is the history of our lives. This, my generation, the generation previous, and even to subsequent generations. And when I talk about this issue, I often say that the reasons for involvement in the criminal legal system are many and varied, but for veterans, they are unique and often really grounded in some of the trauma. My own personal experiences with global war on terror, but your research indicates this has been a pattern for years. The intersection between the military and combat or just military service and arrest and incarceration.
Yes, there are reoccurring and similar themes throughout my interviews and through my research between the generations of the Vietnam War and the global war on terrorism. The biggest difference, I think, is that World War II veterans didn't advocate for Vietnam veterans in the same way that Vietnam veterans currently do with the post 9/11 generation. And I argue that's a terrible lesson of the Vietnam War experience, that so many Vietnam veterans today are volunteering as advocates in their communities to enable post 9/11 veterans to readjust in a better way because they didn't have that experience with the World War II. The stories are that the Second World War generation kind of turned their backs on Vietnam veterans in a way. And that's not universally true, I don't think. I think it's part myth and part memory. But that memory, I would argue, has propelled a generation of Vietnam veterans to become advocates for veterans of today's youth. The fact that Vietnam veterans are volunteering in these veteran treatment courts and scores, if not hundreds of them, are volunteering for veterans who are involved in the criminal justice system today is really evidence of that. And the founders of the vet courts in Buffalo were Vietnam vets too, except for Judge Russell, who was not a veteran.
But I think about just globally, things that happened in the 70s, in the 80s, deinstitutionalization, different approaches to mental health care, post-traumatic stress disorder in the early 80s, first identified, but not really, I guess, habituated until the mid-90s. And so really this story about exposure to combat, military service, the psychological impacts of military service, as you were talking about before, substance use, reactions to trauma, all of these things, ultimately, and the way I describe it is a veteran ends up in the back of a cop car.
Yeah. And those stories are familiar, especially in places where I grew up, where access to the middle class American dream are limited. I come from an impoverished environment. So a lot of the people I grew up with went into this cycle of trauma and drug use and incarceration, and then their children are caught in the cycle. But with military veterans, you have those same dynamics, except that it is exacerbated by oftentimes the experience of war. So these are people who have a lot of the problems that most Americans face if they're working class, but then they go off to war, oftentimes hoping for a path toward opportunity, a chance to defend their nation, motivated by all the right reasons. And then something happens during that time at war or in the military that prevents them from being able to reintegrate successfully. Or oftentimes they come back to those same communities and fall into those same types of patterns. That's certainly one thing I've noticed. One of the things I think that really illuminated this topic for me was when I started studying African-American history. It was most prominent during the Vietnam War that Black soldiers and Black veterans after the war experienced discrimination. And that's a huge factor to add on top of all of the problems that veterans faced after the Vietnam War. They faced all the same problems while often also dealing with institutionalized racism, discrimination, less than honorable discharges, disabilities, undocumented trauma. You mentioned PTSD was first identified in 1980 with the DSM-3, but there were other manifestations of trauma that were known, Vietnam Stress Syndrome, for example. So all of those problems, in addition to record unemployment rates during the 1970s, African Americans were more likely to be discharged with a less than honorable discharge. So all of those factors converge and create this moment, as you mentioned, during deinstitutionalization, where mental health is being treated as a deviant behavior that would be punished by the criminal justice system. Whenever scholars talk about mass incarceration and the emergence of it, it's happening at the same time as the end of the Vietnam War. So Nixon declares a war on drugs at the same time that veterans are coming home with all of these problems. So it's a convergence of factors that make Vietnam veterans, and particularly African-American Vietnam veterans, far more likely to go to prison compared to World War II. And today, Vietnam veterans are still the largest incarcerated population of veterans. Recently, the most recent Department of Justice study concluded that Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans combined now outnumber the Vietnam generation. But that really does illustrate the enduring effects of these changes, both within the criminal justice system and social changes that come out of the 1970s, is that for 50 years, this has been the largest population.
And I think as I'm hearing you talking, and given the time that we have, that is very much that broad overview approach. But again, what you, I get a sense, is really value is, it's not just the research and building off the source material, but original interviews and oral histories, like the actual stories of individuals. You say that this large group, both Vietnam veterans and Gulf War veterans, Global War on Terror veterans, but that's really how you've built the book, is on oral histories and interviews and individual stories. What can you tell us about the book, maybe your approach to the topic, and maybe what you hope that this book might do to guide some of these conversations?
My approach to writing the book was to center human experience, to center the voices of the veterans who entrusted me with their stories. I contextualize them with my historical analysis, and sometimes I may reach different conclusions than they might believe. And I tried to differentiate that between my analysis as a historian, but I try to center their lived experience as much as possible, which is a different approach than a lot of authors of historical monographs will take. So I tell as many stories as I can, but I put those in a greater context. And that's where my analysis comes into play. One of the surprising things that really came out of the research was resiliency. Veterans who experienced unimaginable horrors and disclosed those to me, and yet they're survivors, they're not victims. They would transform their lives after these horrible experiences, and then they would dedicate their lives to helping other people in their community. And that was a reoccurring theme, a really powerful theme that emerged from the oral history interviews across generations. And so while the topic of the book is really difficult and at times had serious effects on my own mental health, I was immersed into the worlds of these people who had lost their friends, who had seen the casualties of war, and had experienced in many ways institutional betrayals as well. Yet, after all of that, they still remain dedicated to the idea of service and to helping other people. And so while studying complex history can be really challenging, especially because I study Black history and I study war, these are difficult topics to really, if you let yourself feel it, it can take a toll on you. And I find power in the stories of people who, despite those circumstances, are willing to sacrifice everything to do what's right. Those who find moral courage in situations where there's a lack of morality. and those who are willing to do what's right despite what's going on around them. And that's really powerful. So I tried to highlight those stories. And the other aspect of writing this book was I wanted to show the connections between the generations, because I think we often separate, we categorize, and we say, okay, this is the Vietnam War that ended in 1975. And yet those people who lived it, survived it, are still part of our communities today. And those experiences form who they are and how they interact with the world. So I wanted to show not only personal experiences, but also collective memory and how that influences how Vietnam veterans interact with Iraq and Afghanistan veterans.
Yeah, I can imagine hearing you describe the effort, beneficial not just to those students of history that want to learn more about this, beneficial not just to those individuals who are either in the military learning about the incarceration system or vice versa, but even service members, veterans themselves, to get a greater understanding of where they fit. If folks wanted to find out more, get the book, is there a place online that they can access?
Sure. The easiest place is Amazon. That's not the first place I usually recommend. You can get it right now for 20% off if you order it directly from the University of Massachusetts Press with the code UMass20. There will be an open access free ebook version. It has not been available online yet, but I expect that within the next week or two. And probably whenever the show airs, it will be available. You should be able to find that from the UMass Press website as well. I received a tome grant to make an open access version of this available because I wanted to give the stories back. I wanted this book to be read by the people who experience these historical topics that I'm writing about, but also to honor the generosity of those who shared their stories with me. I want to share it back. Most academic presses are nonprofit to begin with, but I especially believe in the power of open access to credible information. I think it's essential to the work of democracy. And therefore, I applied for a tome grant, received it, and hopefully it'll be read by people. I just want it to be read. And it can be difficult at times to read. It was difficult at times to write. But I think that I learned throughout the process, and I hope to share those lessons with other people.
Yeah, I think that's great. Now make sure that all of those links are in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for generously inviting me. And I want to thank you for your advocacy of veterans in the criminal justice system, being a mentor yourself at a veteran treatment court. I find those stories so inspiring. I'd love to talk to you sometime. Maybe you would sit down for an interview with me. I'm also very impressed by the work happening in Colorado. I did interview an Afghanistan war veteran who was incarcerated in Colorado, and he was able to transform his life because there were people willing to give him the benefit of doubt. I think because he was a military veteran, the community saw him as deserving of a second chance, and he made the most out of that opportunity. And really, my hope is that by the public understanding the conditions and the context in which people go to jail or prison, they can see that the humanity of those people.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much for your work.
Yeah, thank you.
Once again, we would like to thank this week's sponsor, PsychArmor. PsychArmor is the premier education and learning ecosystem specializing in military culture content. PsychArmor offers an online e-learning laboratory that's free to individual learners, as well as custom training options for organizations. As I mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, this is a topic that is particularly meaningful to me. I have a family history of veterans being involved in the criminal legal system, as well as those that I've served in combat with having been involved in it. The very first day I went to a session of my local veteran court to consider becoming a mentor, and where I ultimately became a clinician, I had a meaningful experience. When I walked in and looked over to where veterans in custody were being held, I saw a soldier that I had served with in Iraq. This is 6 years after I had been the one to meet him at the gate of our base to provide him support after he had seen his platoon sergeant get shot in front of him. There was a direct line between what happened in Iraq and him sitting in an orange jumpsuit in a courtroom in Colorado. I was there on both ends of that line. As I mentioned, I subsequently went on to be a clinician for justice-involved veterans for a number of years, and even engaged with some veterans in the Colorado Department of Corrections who were serving time after being convicted or pleading guilty. One of the points that I'd like to make about the conversation with Dr. Higgins is that he's right and tells us something that we all know intuitively. The story of a person doesn't end when they leave the military or when the war ends, whether the war ends for everyone or the war ends for that person in particular. And people react differently, of course. A lot of it has to do with the measure of support available, both through the veteran's personal network and the community that the veteran returns to. But that complex interplay of military experience, reintegration, returning to old habits, or picking up new ones can often be complicated. Here's another relevant story. I once had the opportunity to spend a weekend at a 3-day retreat in which you had a group of us combat vets, a group of ex-cons from Folsom, and a group of other individuals who had neither background, and all of us together were going through a weekend of talking and healing practices. It was interesting, as you can imagine, but I remember one ex-con, as they referred to themselves. He had served in the Army. He was in the 82nd Airborne Division in Panama, then deployed to the Persian Gulf War. After leaving the military in the early 90s, he went back to San Francisco, got involved in gang life, and was sent to prison in 1992. He spent 21 years in prison, getting out in 2013. I joined the military in 1992 and retired in 2014. Essentially, the entire length of my military career he spent in prison after experiencing combat. One of the things I remember him telling me was that it was his military mindset, the hierarchy, the ability to withstand hardship, that was one of the things that kept him going in prison. And the other thing was, that line between being a veteran and a con is not as clear as many might think. I, for one, recognize that I'm one bad decision away from being in the same situation, and that's true for a lot of veterans. The other point that I'd like to make is how Dr. Higgins mentioned his respect and appreciation for resilience after hardship. I know that many veterans tend to shy away from the term resilient, much as they feel a certain way about thank you for your service. It seems to be a term that's often thrown out as a way to wrap a bow on a subject or put it in a neat box. And yes, resilience to hardship is something to value. Those who are resilient to physical, psychological, and social pressure are to be honored. People like Dr. Martin Luther King and those that worked with him that showed amazing resilience in the face of extreme opposition. Or women who were able to use their voice to address the presence of sexual violence and coercion in the workplace. But this is the thing about resilience. It can be an inherent property, but very often it's an emergent property. And while we value and celebrate resilience, we often lose sight of the genesis of that resilience was really horrific and even unwelcome and unwanted. You don't know that you're resilient until you've been tested, and often those tests don't come because you want them to. Sometimes they do. I didn't know that I could make it through basic training or jump master school or graduate school for that matter. I thought I could, others had before me, so therefore it was theoretically possible that I could too, but there was no guarantee, and I didn't know until I had done it. But more often, resilience is identified and developed because of unwanted and unavoidable stress and even, in many cases, trauma. So to celebrate resilience without acknowledging the unwanted trauma that developed that resilience might somehow smooth over the whole process. To value the outcome without recognizing the source. I have to say that I certainly don't believe that's what Dr. Higgins was referring to. I firmly believe that he recognizes the importance of both the source and the outcome, probably even better than I do for the veterans he interviewed. But it was still a point that I thought worth discussing. If you're interested, as I am, I recommend that you take a look at his book, which will be linked in the show notes. So I hope you appreciated this conversation with Dr. Higgins. If you did, we would appreciate hearing from you, so if you do have some feedback, let us know. Drop a review in your podcast player of choice, or send us an email at info@psycharmor.org. We're always glad to hear from listeners, both feedback on the show and suggestions for future guests. For this week's PsycArmor Resource of the Week, I'd like to share the PsycArmor course, Supporting Someone with Invisible Wounds. Not all wounds can be seen, and invisible wounds are just as serious as visible ones. This course introduces four types of invisible wounds: post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, substance use disorder, and depression. Find a link to the resource in our show notes. So thanks again for taking the time to listen to this episode. Make sure to take a look at the show notes, which you can find in the podcast app, as well as on the PsycArmor website at psycharmor.org/podcast. While you're there, you can find hundreds of online training videos delivered by nationally recognized subject matter experts who are all committed to educating the non-military community about military culture. All of these courses are free to individual learners. You wouldn't be listening if you didn't care, and it's that curiosity and passion for supporting service members, veterans, and their families that we want to encourage and increase. Come back each week for another conversation, and make sure to engage with PsycArmor on social media to let us know what you thought about the show. I'd like to express special thanks to Operation Encore and Navy Seahawk pilot Jerry Maniscalco for our theme song, Don't Kill the Messenger. This show was produced by Headspace and Timing, and all rights to the show remain reserved by PsychArmor. Much appreciation to the team at PsychArmor that makes this show happen. Carol Turner, Vice President of Strategic Communications, who keeps me on track and is an outstanding guest coordinator, and support and transcript by Emma Atherall. Feel free to share the show. In fact, we request that you do, but make sure to let folks know where you heard it. Join us next time for another great episode, and until then, stay aware, get educated, and be well.